This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
As Canada-U.S. trade talks advance, the federal government is telling the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission to adjust how it rolls out the Online Streaming Act and prioritize affordability.
It is another step to reinforce affordability for Canadians. This is not the time to raise the cost for Canadians.
The Online Streaming Act requires digital media giants to spend 5% of Canadian revenue on Canadian content. That was set to triple this year to 15% before the federal government changed its mind.
Earlier this month, the government shocked the culture sector by announcing it was effectively reversing the CRTC decision that implemented the Online Streaming Act. Culture Minister Mark Miller tried to cushion the blow with the promise of $600 million in support for the audio and audiovisual sectors, but there was no escaping the anger from some over abandoning a policy that had been years in the making. Weeks later, it is still not clear what precisely the government intends to do. I recently wrote that it is evident that there is really no plan at all, with the government improvising on critical issues such as the implementation of the reversal, funding for news, and the eventual contribution requirements for internet streamers. This week's episode takes a step back to look at the decision and the reaction that it garnered from key stakeholders. Mark Musselman is a former entertainment lawyer, longtime Canadian movie producer, current PhD student focused on cultural and legal policy, and the author of the excellent white paper Black Coffee Substack. He returns to the Law Bites podcast to discuss the reversal, the stakeholder reaction, and the challenges that lie ahead.
Mark, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back on, Michael.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining again. And I'll just give you a plug right off the top so that for anyone who hasn't found it yet, you write a really great Substack, the White Paper Black Coffee Substack, that focuses on Canadian cultural policy. And it was one of those pieces that really triggered me to say, hey, you know what, I really want to have you come back on the podcast, because your response to the government's reversal on the Online Streaming Act, which was titled What They Said, What They Meant, I think really hit the mark. And I want to spend some time on this, walking through how you believe stakeholders are processing what's happened. But before we do that, let's talk for a moment about what did happen. You know, this area moved so quickly that before I even had time to do a podcast on the CRTC's long-awaited decision on the Online Streaming Act, the government announced that it was going to direct the commission to reconsider the contribution framework that it had just finalized less than 2 weeks earlier. So for anyone just tuning in, can you provide a bit of a brief update on what really has been a dizzying series of events with respect to online streaming, the CRTC, and the government's response?
Sure, but on the understanding, this is the short version, right? So on June 3rd, Mark Miller, who is the Minister of Canadian Identity and Culture, directed the CRTC to go back and reconsider the contribution framework, which had been delivered 2 weeks earlier, and which was to triple what foreign streamers have to spend on Canadian content, tripling it from a 5% number that was laid out by the commission on an interim basis to a 15% number, and that is 15% of Canadian revenues. So that framework was the product of 3 years of CRTC work. It lasted a total of 12 days before Ottawa stepped in. And Miller, I think as a nod to the Canadian production industry, paired the reversal with a $600 million federal commitment to the sector, which he framed as a bridge, while a new policy direction and a CRTC funding framework gets sorted out. So that's where we came from. And here we are now waiting for the new policy direction to drop.
Right. And we'll talk about that in a bit. The focus has certainly been on the reversal. There have been a number of media stories that have interviewed Miller about all this. But, you know, one of your focal points in the piece is that it's not so simple to just overturn a CRTC decision in this area, the Broadcasting Act doesn't have a review and vary power over contribution and expenditure decisions, and governor and council's review authority is really limited to licensing. So, as you say, the government has to issue a fresh policy direction. That would be the second policy direction for this bill. So it's now the second time they're trying to tell the regulator what they really mean in this legislation. And in the meantime, there's the $600 million. You've called the distinction here legally meaningful, but practically irrelevant. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. I called the distinction legally meaningful, but practically irrelevant, because the mechanism may matter enormously to a constitutional or administrative lawyer, but it doesn't matter at all to anyone else who is trying to figure out what just happened to Canadian cultural policy. The CRTC is going to get the message, and they're going to reconsider its framework accordingly after receiving the government's new policy direction. Some argue that the legal form in this case preserves what is a fiction, that the commission is independent. But the practical effect, regardless, is that a politically inconvenient decision got reversed inside of 2 weeks by the people who ultimately have the power to reverse it, I think.
Yeah. Now, there is that question about why they reversed it. You know, when I remember reading the release that morning, and you had to drill down a little bit to actually find what was really what had really happened, because, of course, the focal point was on the $600 million, and this at first read like yet another government announcement about more funding for the culture sector. But once you drill down, you found that, well, no, there's actually much more here. But the release itself never mentions words like trade, retaliation, CUSMA, the USMCA, or the United States. Yet during questions from reporters, it clearly played a role at a minimum, probably a pretty big role. Your translation of his statement was, we're responding to U.S. trade pressure and prefer you not notice. You know, how much do you think this really reads as a consumer affordability decision, which was in large measure how they tried to frame it, and how much of it is really just a trade retreat that is looking for a convenient excuse?
Well, I think it's almost entirely the latter. And I think the evidence has only become stronger since I wrote that piece. You're right to note that the original press release didn't once say CUSMA, trade, United States. But Miller, shortly afterwards, in front of reporters at the Banff Media Festival, he was considerably more candid than his own department's press release was. And he said outright that it's, quote, I have this quote in front of me, it's no secret to anyone that's been paying any attention to this that the U.S. trade representative has identified these issues as trade issues, unquote. And I think that's about as close as an admission you're going to get from an administrator. Layer on to that the timing, CUSMA coming up for formal review July 1st. The U.S. ambassador had publicly called the CRTC's decision a discriminatory trade barrier, and the Motion Picture of Association's Canadian branch had litigated, which resulted in much of the streamers' existing contributions being frozen. So as for the affordability case itself, Michael, I'd want to see it made with actual numbers before I believed it. You know, France compels foreign streamers to invest between 20 and 25% of local revenue into French production. Italy requires 16%. I think Germany is pushing for around 8. Canada's framework before it got reversed was 15. So if contribution obligations of that size were really driving subscription prices the way Ottawa's release implies, you'd expect Netflix and Disney Plus subscribers in France or in Italy to be paying noticeably more than Canadians were about to. But nobody in government has shown that work. And when a reporter in Banff asked Miller directly whether Ottawa had done the economic research on pricing, he didn't jump to defend the correlation. In fact, he pivoted to a different cost mechanism entirely, which was something about production costs rising in higher obligation jurisdictions. So I think that's a significant telling move. If the price pressure story were solid, The minister had every reason to lean into it, but instead he changed the subject the moment the original claim was put to him directly. So for me, the affordability framing is real in the sense that it's a fact about consumer prices generally, but nobody has shown it's true in the specific causal sense. The government needs it to be true. And that this obligation at this size would have produced that price increase, it's just not the reason that this decision got made on this timeline.
Yeah. No, that's fair. And listen, there's obviously a lot of focus on the cost implications and what consumers would ultimately pay. It's an issue certainly that I've raised really from the outset. And, one can understand why a government would want to put that forward, but at a minimum, it's pretty clear there are other issues that were playing into all of this. Why don't we continue a bit with the government's response? As I mentioned off the top, you took 6 press releases and gave each essentially a translation, why they're saying what they're saying. So why don't we stick with the government for a moment with their own statement? Because you called it really the most polished of the bunch and one that works on 2 levels simultaneously. What did you mean by that?
Well, this press release was constructed to be read 2 completely different ways by 2 completely different audiences. A consumer reads it as the government is protecting you from a price increase. But a trade lawyer or a U.S. trade representative or even a U.S. ambassador to Canada reads it as, we heard you, we're fixing it, no hard feelings. Both readers come away satisfied. So that's a genuinely skillful piece of drafting. And as I wrote when I said, we blinked because of tariffs is a really hard sentence to put in a government press release. But saying we're protecting your Netflix bill is a very easy one. And it's the most sophisticated of the 6 statements by far, because it's the only one that had to do what is really diplomatic work while also pretending to do something else entirely.
Okay. No, that's fair. Okay. Now there are a whole series of additional releases, a bunch from the production side, a bunch from essentially the streamer side. Let's start with the production side. It won't come, I think, to many as much of a surprise to know where the themes were there. The CMPA said the government, quote, sold out Canadian culture. ACTRA said that Ottawa shifted the bill to taxpayers under the guise of consumer protection. And the Directors Guild wants a stable long-term financing framework. The $600 million is nice, but it's not really what they're anxious to get. Now, your translation of all 3 is some version of, well, the only question being asked is who gets stuck with the bill. But then you push past that a bit to a question you say appears in none of the releases. What's that question and why does nobody ask it?
Right. It's important to remember here that we've got different advocacy organizations with different memberships trying to support different positions, but structurally the statements are identical. Each one frames the issue as who pays. And, ACTRA's position is, well, the government sold out Canadian culture. Well, what that means is the government has stopped money flowing to CMPA members. ACTRA says, yes, taxpayers are going to have to pay. Well, that's true, but it takes for granted that someone has to be made to pay for this industry to exist in the first place. And the DGC wants, as you mentioned, stable financing framework. They don't mention how many stable long-term financing frameworks this sector has cycled through over 60 years while remaining, by its own account, still unstable. So the question no one asks in these releases is, why does an industry that's existed for 60 years through multiple regulatory regimes and billions in public subsidy still require a permanent, mandatory, externally imposed subsidy to function? And nobody asks it, because answering it honestly would force all of these organizations to admit that the system was built to sustain an industry that has, by its own admission, been unable to stand on its own 2 legs for more than 60 years.
You as we record this, you can't see me, but I am nodding my head vigorously in support for what I think you just said. I think that really is one of the big questions. Perhaps we'll come back to it towards the end in terms of what the policy frameworks ought to look like if we were asking some of these harder questions.
Mm-hmm.
Before we do that, though, the other side, of course, those that were unsurprisingly really happy with the outcome. I mentioned the Motion Picture Association's Canadian branch, Netflix, Disney, Amazon, the streamers themselves, who have been in litigation over the framework, and unsurprisingly then put out a statement saying that, you know, they're happy and that they look forward to supporting Canadian stories. You noted, I think, that it's a good deal easier to support those Canadian stories when nobody is forcing you to pay for them. Rogers, right, a domestic broadcaster, also said it was pleased. Can you talk a bit about both, sort of the MPA's victory lap, as it were, but also what does Rogers being supportive of this tell us about where they stand on some of these issues?
Yeah, I have to hand it to the Motion Picture Association's press release. It's pretty polished in a different way than the government's is. It thanks Ottawa without gloating. It flags these unresolved concerns without naming any of them. And it commits to what? Well, it commits to engaging. So that's great. 2 weeks before they issue that statement, the MPA was in the Federal Court of Appeal arguing the CRTC's entire framework was unlawful. Now, it's clear that the studios are happy with the government's change of heart. Rogers, on the other hand, it's a bit more interesting because it isn't a streamer. It's a domestic broadcasting incumbent complaining about a framework that on paper was supposed to favor it relative to the Americans, calling the CRTC's quotas, I think they said, complicated and onerous. I think that's corporate language to say it's time to do away with all of this regulation. And what that statement omits is that Rogers spent years resisting the Online Streaming Act in the first place, when it wanted a lighter regulatory environment for everyone. And the sudden enthusiasm for fairness only shows up, I think, once fairness means leveling the field, but leveling it downward towards what the Americans will have to pay.
Yeah, no, I think there's always been a bit of a complicated relationship with the broadcasters / communications companies that are now really one in the same, and how they relate to a lot of this. And I think you've highlighted where some of those complications come from. You know, speaking of complicated, the CRTC's response, sort of lastly, is the one that in some ways stays with me the most, just because you look at an organization that I believe engaged in 4 consultations, hundreds of submissions just on the contribution issue alone, a 3-week hearing with 120 plus groups, years of work, and a framework that lasts 12 days. And so the commission, one could understand almost any kind of response to that, but their response was an unsigned email to a journalist, you know, that says it would review whatever the government sends. You called that the most honest statement of the week. You know, what does this entire episode really tell us about where the CRTC actually sits as part of the system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a tough one. Yeah, you can assess the commission's response on a technical level. Yes, of course, they'll review the new policy direction. But beyond that, I really found the commission's response quite, sad, the right word. Sad, maybe to the extent that one can have an emotional response to the challenges of a federal broadcast regulator. But I called it the most honest statement of the week because it's the only one that was issued without any spin. It doesn't have any, there's no claim of victory or grievance, no performance of outrage, just a really accurate statement of what the CRTC's position in this system actually is. It's an administrative body that processes whatever direction the cabinet hands it. Vicky Atreides' keynote at the Banff Festival kind of confirmed it. She covered some history of the Broadcasting Act and talked about the growth of the CRTC's regulatory mandate, touched on discoverability. But what she didn't speak to was what she was living through. The framework that her commission had just spent 3 years building was reversed in under 2 weeks. She didn't give any explanation or defense of the 15% framework that she and her colleagues had determined was appropriate. And there was no acknowledgement that her own authority had just been shown to be conditional. So that's not a regulator defending its relevance or its independence. That's an agency choosing institutional continuity. It's really choosing that on the one occasion when continuity is exactly what hadn't happened. And proof, I think, that the CRTC has over many years internalized how little independence it actually has, certainly at a moment when cabinet decides otherwise.
Yeah. No, and that lack of independence may play out even further, I think, in the coming weeks, as we see how the government tries to reverse, really before a bit of a deadline that it faces in terms of payments that are otherwise due, and frankly, an inability to use the typical route to make that happen. We'll see if mm-hmm. the RTC is responsive to it. You know, that actually does lead a little bit to what happens now. So a really interesting look at that initial response. You know, I've recently written that the government response anyway, at least over the last number of weeks since that decision, feels like a bit like improv policy with making it up as it goes along. And I don't have the sense the government really knows what to do. But if we assume that it figures it out and issues a new policy direction, it may take a number of months, but assuming that happens, I assume that means we then get the CRTC opening up a new proceeding. You know, realistically, what do you think comes out at the other end? Is it a watered down version of the same framework? Is it the government really dictating what all of this ought to look like, which some might say perhaps they ought to have done in the legislation itself? Or is it a contribution model that largely survives in name only?
Yeah, I read your article this morning. I think it's great, and I really like your improv characterization. Improv generally means no script. It's dialogue that's purely reactive, no sort of pre-existing strategy or structure. But I think I have a slightly different riff on that theme. And there was supposed to be a script here. In fact, there was a script. The CRTC spent 3 years writing one, with hearings and submissions and data analysis and really careful policy work. You or I might not agree with where the CRTC ultimately came down with its conclusions, but it's tough to argue with its administrative process at all. But when they finished the script and delivered it, the government fired them and said, you know, we're going to, in essence, we're going to write our own. And that's not really improv. That's, you know, in film and television world, that's a producer tearing up a finished screenplay. Aside from what it means to the Canadian cultural sector, it tells you something genuinely bad about regulatory independence in this country, that independent regulator lasts exactly as long as the regulator's conclusion remains convenient. But anyway, as for what comes next, good question. I think the plan is to buy time and figure out the number later. The $600 million that Minister Miller is characterizing as a bridge, primarily meant to placate the industrial sector, I think. When the CRTC opens its new proceeding, I'd expect the result to be a contribution obligation meaningfully below the 15% level. Miller himself has referred to France's rate of, I think I said 20 to 25%, and Germany's coming in at 8%. And he signaled in connection with those thresholds that Canada isn't going there. My guess is that a CRTC will ultimately find a contribution level somewhere in the mid single digits, all dressed up in quote unquote fairness and international comparators and affordability arguments, so that it survives in form, but pegs it at a value that the streamers can stomach. And the biggest take home might be that the number matters less than what produced it. A framework that was built on really ultimately 12 days of trade pressure isn't going to be a modest version of the same policy. I think it screams different policy entirely, and one whose real audience is in Washington.
Yeah, no, that's a really good description of where we may end up. I want to talk about what that different look might look like and some of the things we ought to be thinking about. But just quickly before we do, you know, the government, Miller, has been talking to the streamers. And I'm getting this sort of deja vu all over again sense with the Online News Act, where the government insisted for many months as part of that bill that it was setting the table for negotiation. It was not doing the actual negotiation, and it would be up to the media outlets and the two large platforms at the time, Meta and Google, to do the actual negotiating. We, of course, know that in the interim, Meta just started blocking news, and that left Google. And at the end of the day, it really was the government just negotiating directly mm-hmm. with Google with a bespoke piece of regulation to make it happen. It feels right. as if we may be headed in much the same direction, where when you talk about, well, maybe it's single digits, we'll see what the number happens to be. It's starting to sound like perhaps this will actually be what happens, where the government sits down with the streamers and basically negotiates out what's the number, in which case that lack of independence for the CRTC is even worse than one might imagine. It's basically being told, here's the number, make it look like this is a reasonable regulatory decision.
Right, right. Yeah, the government will sit down or has already sat down. Who knows? It's hard not to see the parallel with the Online News Act. You're absolutely right. Minister Miller, you know, has now said on the record that Ottawa will have that conversation with streamers, which is a different thing entirely than saying that your broadcast regulator will determine the appropriate contribution level through its normal process. I mean, we are heading down a new and perhaps well-trodden path. But if that's where this lands, you know, with bilateral conversations with Netflix and Disney and Amazon about what they're willing to pay, with the CRTC, I guess, just sort of formalizing whatever comes out the other end, then the entire 3-year proceeding must be sort of retroactively reframed as a negotiating position rather than a genuine regulatory determination. And that's a pretty remarkable thing for a government to concede about its own regulatory agency, I think.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. It's pretty astonishing. You know, why don't we close with this? You know, there was a part of your piece that didn't focus on the translation piece, but it was a section called What None of Them Said. And your argument, I think, was that the system is built to sustain an industry, not a culture, and the two aren't necessarily the same thing. So as we look ahead to this sort of potentially dramatically changed environment in terms of how policy gets made and what that policy even looks like, is there a version of Canadian cultural policy that supports a culture rather than sustaining an industry? And if there is, what are some of the honest first steps that we might take to move in that direction?
Well, I think the honest first step isn't yet another funding formula. I think it's admitting to ourselves why we've never wanted to ask the harder question. Because funding an industry is administratively doable. You know, you count the spend, you count the jobs, you count the points on a certification table, you disperse the money, and you declare success. But funding a culture is not simple. It requires you to do the really hard work of determining clearly what you're trying to achieve and then find out honestly whether you achieved it. And for 60 years, Canada has taken the easy route and supported an industry because the easy route is fundable and measurable, and frankly, it's politically safe. And the hard route of funding culture is none of those things. I acknowledge that. But that trade-off may have been defensible once in the 60s, in the 70s, even in the 1980s, you could make a real argument that a fragile, undeveloped or underdeveloped industry needed support to survive next to the largest media market on earth. But we are not in that world anymore. We're in a world with, you know, upwards of $4 billion in a year in support flowing to this sector with no empirical evidence that it is actually achieving its stated cultural purpose. And a federal government facing genuine fiscal pressures and a long list of urgent priorities that simply didn't exist when the system was designed in the 1950s. So at some point, I think Canadians are going to start asking whether that number for that return still makes sense. Not because anyone wants to destroy an industry, or not because anyone doesn't believe who we are as a nation and as citizens is important, but because no expenditure of that size should be permanently exempt from the question of whether it works or not. And the industry itself will not ask that question and has no incentive to try to answer it. That's not a criticism of the people in the industry. It's just what self-interest predictably does. But it means that somebody else has to ask it if we're ever going to take what you've asked for, which is an honest first step.
Okay. Well, I'm glad someone is asking that question. And I think you're doing a really nice job of highlighting sort of the changes that we've seen over the years and the incompatibility in some senses of where the policy is at from the realities of what the sector and the broader market looks like today. And, you know, asking the questions about what is it that we're actually trying to achieve here is would seem like the obvious first question, but for too long, it's been the question people are avoiding. So,
yeah, I think it's hard work, but I think it's work that we have to do.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And I'm glad that you're one of the people that's doing it. Thank you for that work. And thank you for taking the time to join me here on the podcast.
Well, it was a pleasure, Michael. Again, thanks for having me on.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at POBOX.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBitesPod, or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.